It's the book club for kids.
It's the book club for kids.
It's the book club for kids.
It's the book club for kids podcast.
Hi, I'm Kitty Faldi. Last week, writer Holly Goldberg Sloan told us why she wrote her best-selling novel, Counting by Sevens.
I think that I write about the reunification of family. I'm very interested in the notion of how many people it actually takes to hold us all together.
But there's more to the story. Coming up in this bonus episode of the Book Club for Kids, more from writer Holly Goldberg Sloan. So Holly, you told us last week that seven is your favorite number, but how do we get to the complete title, Counting by Sevens?
The reason the book is called Counting by Sevens is because at one point, my mother was ill, and I took her to a doctor. My mother's older, obviously. And the doctor said, well, we need to start by determining if she has any mental impairment. She was about a foot away from him when he said that. But she had been exhibiting strange behavior. So he said, we have a very simple way to tell if somebody has cognitive function. And what we do is we ask the person to count backwards from 100 by 7. It's actually harder than it thinks if people are staring at you. So he said, he looked at her and he said, 100, go. And she said, 93, 86, 79. She started doing it, and she was doing it in a fairly fast manner. So then he turned to me and said, whatever's going on with her, she's got her mind together. And I said, so that's the trick, counting by sevens? And he said, that is one of the tricks. So I remembered that, counting by sevens. It's a way to see if a person is sane. And the book is about, in a way, what happens when you've had a huge loss in your life, and you sort of go nuts. But there are many times in life, if you live a big and full life, that you feel like you might be losing it. So my suggestion is always ask yourself, can you count backwards from 100 by sevens?
So counting by sevens touches on, I mean, it starts with very serious, heavy-duty topic. It's generally not something, I mean, a lot of books for middle-grade readers deal with death, but this one feels there's a whole lot more gravity to it. Did you have second thoughts at all about going right there, right away, with your readers?
Charlotte's Web originally started with chapter 4. Everybody knows that Charlotte's Web opening line, maybe the most famous opening line in children's literature, where is Papa going with the axe? But E.B. White didn't write it that way. E.B. White started the book describing the farm. And I didn't write Counting by Sevens opening the way I did. I changed that. E.B. White changed Charlotte's Web because his editor said, you need to right away put the pig in jeopardy. You need to right away let people know what it's about. And the same thing happened with Counting by Sevens. I had the beginning talking about Willow and her life and going to school, and it was funny. It was light-hearted. And then there was just a shift because one day she came home and found that there had been a terrible accident, and it was too much. You couldn't as a reader make that shift. And my editor said, what are we going to do? And I remembered about E.B. White. And I said, can I try to reorder the book? And that happens a lot. I think because I come from film and TV, I understand that you can move things, that you can tell stories by how you put the order of the story. And that a lot of it is tone and how you set a reader up, which means expectation. I think it's interesting that the cover of the book has fish and a single fish that's going down. When I first saw that cover, I asked if we could change it and the fish could be going up. And they said, no, the fish is going down. The book is about the reader turning the fish around and sending the fish up. There is something about the story of a kid in Bakersfield, California, that's very universal. She loses what matters most, but she finds a way to replace it. And that idea that we go on, that we find a way to overcome tragedy, which can be big or small, is really what the human condition is. It's possible that for children, books matter more because they haven't had so much experience and they might not know that. And that's really what I want to tell them, is that life goes on.
You come from a screenwriting background. Why write this story as a middle grade novel?
Middle grade is really the sweet spot, I have to say. The voice that I have inside me most relates to that time. And I think it's more my sensibility. I like firsts, the first time you do something. I think that at that age, the middle grade age, is when everything changes. Your body changes. Your relationship with the world changes. And for me, it makes stories have so much impact. So I like the middle grade audience.
What would have been lost if you had written Counting by Sevens as a screenplay rather than a middle grade novel?
Well, since we hope to make it into a movie, then you can answer that question later by saying what was lost. But right now, I'm obsessed with looking at film and television. And this isn't a discovery, but I feel it more than I ever have before, that the things that I like to see dramatized, either for television or for film, come from books. So everything from Harry Potter, they come from books, The Wizard of Oz, which I'm obsessed with, a series of books, and that's because you're allowed to do more in a book. Film is a distillation, and it also has to do with point of view, getting inside someone's head. That's much harder to do in the film experience. I wrote it because the current situation in film and television is less supportive of what I would say are contemporary realistic fiction stories. Television has moved there, but film hasn't. And I really spent my career, I wrote Angels in the Outfield, I wrote and directed The Big Green. I'm the first woman to direct a live action film for the Walt Disney Company. I don't know that anyone would make Angels in the Outfield today or The Big Green. I wrote a movie called Made in America. It made $100 million worldwide. That's in 1992. And yet today, I don't think a major studio, and that was a major studio, Universal, would release that. That story would seem too small, too personal to them, and it's not coming from something branded. It didn't come from a book. So now if I want to tell personal stories, I can write books, and then they feel it's branded. They feel that there's an audience for it. I've proved it. There's a thing they talk about today, proof of concept. You have to prove people are interested. And I suppose comic books, and this is not a knock on Marvel, but pre-existing stories with superheroes, they translate, they travel worldwide, but so do personal stories. And maybe television is where those are told, but I made my living writing for film.
You've had an interesting upbringing, I hear.
My father is a social scientist who's interested in decision-making, one of his main areas. And because of that, we traveled a lot because he consulted. He was a consultant to the Peace Corps. He had two Fulbright Awards. So I went to grade school in Holland. I went to high school in Turkey. My dad taught at Stanford. My dad taught at Berkeley. We moved every 3 years. And I think that looking at my childhood now, it's pretty obvious to me that the moving the way I did, making new friends, being in new places, seeing new cultures, I can tell when I read my books that a part of me from being a young girl was really influenced by the way we lived. My mother was an architect. She's very outgoing. She was in the Navy. I've never met anyone like my parents, and I've never heard of anyone had a childhood like my childhood. At one point, we lived for 4 months in a tent. And my parents, this sounds like child abuse now, but it was a different time. My parents would feed us dinner in the campsite. This was in Europe. And then they would zip up the tent and drive off. I'm not kidding. and they'd say, we'll be back. And they would go into town because the campsites were outside of town, and they would find a great restaurant. My parents love food. And they would have dinner and come home. And we trusted them implicitly. And we often would fall asleep. We never heard them come home. I have no memory of hearing them come home. But one night in Yugoslavia, they left us and there was a huge storm. And the tent blew over. We realized they were gone. That's just one of the happy childhood memories. At one point, I had a pet goat. And his name was Ernie. And he wasn't that gratifying as a pet because you could call Ernie and he wouldn't come. But if you were holding anything Ernie might eat, which could be anything, it could be a piece of plastic, then he would come over. And Ernie was chained to a stump because he would just wander anywhere. So he's chained, he's outside, smelled very badly. So we would bring Ernie into the house whenever my parents weren't home. We always thought we could turn him into a dog, but... And at one time, my parents left, and we had Ernie in the house. We had wall-to-wall green carpeting, and we turned, and Ernie had eaten a whole... There was a part that looked like it had been mowed. We were screaming, no, get Ernie out of the house! We get Ernie out of the house. Then my dad had... We had to go live in Washington, D.C. at one point because my father was working for the Peace Corps, starting the Peace Corps. He was doing the tests to determine whether a person would be good to be in the Peace Corps. And so... I remember my parents taking Ernie and they put him in this trailer and we took him to a farm auction and we watched as this couple bought Ernie. I don't know why they couldn't do that without us watching our pet goat be auctioned. And then the couple bought the goat and we ran up to say goodbye and we got in the car. And I remember my mother turning to me and saying, I think they plan on eating him. Which, that's not exactly, that is not comforting, really. But they were comforting people. But I'm just saying that they were not run-of-the-mill parents. I mean, it's not running with scissors, but they were not, they were free spirits. They danced all the time. My parents were both intellectuals, and they're both alive. So they could be listening to this. So I want to say I really appreciate my childhood in ways that I understand now. And they're both amazing people.
Thanks, Holly. Now, if you missed the complete episode, you can find it on our website, bookclubforkids.org. And by the way, have you written a review of Book Club for Kids on iTunes yet? Well, please take a moment, write a couple of sentences, and leave us a rating. Book Club for Kids is funded in part by the D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities, an agency supported in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, and by listeners like you. Thanks this week to Jonathan Jensen, who composed and performed our music, and Emma Steinkellner, who designed our logo, and thanks to writer Holly Goldberg-Sloan. We have a free newsletter for teachers, parents, and librarians full of free tips about how to turn kids into lifelong readers. You can sign up at our website, bookclubforkids.org. I'm Kitty Feldy. Thanks again for listening. Thank you.